Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammā sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammā sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammā sambuddhassa. Aparuta de sangamatasa tavara ye soravantava muntantu sadam. Evening, we're invited to give a Dharma talk or reflection, and I like the word reflection because anything I say is for that purpose. I'm not trying to convert you or convince you anything, but to the point of say is to awaken us to a fully conscious, using our consciousness completely, to be completely with this present moment. And so in the meditation we're not trying to become Buddhists or acquire all kinds of Buddhist ideas, Buddhist teachings, Buddhist perceptions in order to become Buddhists, but to awaken ourselves to the way things are, to the Dhamma, to the truth of the way it is. So this, the awakened one is translation of the Buddha. So the word itself isn't pointing to a personality or a historical figure or to some kind of abstract force in the universe, but to our own ability to be awake, to be awakened one here and now. So it's that immediate, it's apparent here and now, timeless, encouraging investigation, leading inward to be experienced individually by the wise. These are what we chant in regards to the Dhamma. So the Buddha is the knowing of the Dhamma, the awakened state of our being, present. The Buddhist teachings then are not doctrines in terms of belief systems that we have to believe in Buddhist ideas or Buddhist teachings of any sort. They're not for belief but for investigation. So they're teachings pointing at experience, at the way things are in terms of our own individual experience. Apparent here and now, so it's not in some kind of abstract idea of apparent here and now as something that is very kind of subtle and remote, but awakening to the way it is now as you're experiencing this present moment. So then the Buddha established his teaching of the Four Noble Truths, he used the experience of dukkha or suffering as the first noble truth. So he's actually raising suffering up to something that is noble rather than something that means that there's something wrong or we've got to get rid of it. Or we blame it on others. So when we put this dukkha into this position of the first noble truth, the awakening to dukkha because suffering is a common human experience that we can all recognize. And suffering from the time, at the time of the Buddha, Gautama the Buddha, 2,544 years ago, and the suffering that you happen to be experiencing at this very moment are really not any different. It's not like suffering based on culture or on some kind of economic situation or political situation or on any condition, but on the very state of one when we are ignorant, when we aren't awakened to the truth, then our life is the experience of suffering, because the conditioned realm is that way. It's basically unsatisfactory. It's unsatisfying. And so ignorance always means that we identify with the conditioned realm as ourself. In terms of the five khandhas, the rupa, vedana, sanya, sankhara, vijnana, this is the basic identity that we have, that I am this physical body, it's mine, and my consciousness and my feelings and my memories and my perceptions and my emotional habits and all these are how we tend to interpret experience, here and now experience, always through this filter of delusion. So then when we do that, then we are constantly creating suffering. So even in the most kind of fortunate situations where life is not just a struggle for survival, like most of us come from affluent countries and our experience of life has been generally quite, with so many opportunities and comforts and advantages. And yet, even when life is at its best, there's still this anxiety and this fear connected to it. The fear of death, or the fear of the unknown, or even when we recognize that life is a kind of peak experience of just, everything just seems perfect. There's a part of us that knows that you can't sustain that. You can't expect life to be just a continuous peak experience, life at its best. So we tend to suffer a lot from anxiety, worry. These are the depression, fears, discontentment are common to even the most fortunate, the most wealthy, the most gifted human beings, as long as they remain ignorant of the Dhamma. So in awakening, the Buddha isn't asking us to do anything kind of fantastic. It's not like the teaching is based on the experience of refined consciousness. Is that we're not, as much as we would like to experience life in its more refined aspects, life very much is the experience of both refinement and coarseness. You have to deal with a physical body that is quite coarse in terms of its pain, its functions, and so forth. We have to deal with aging and sickness and disease and pain and discomfort and irritation. When you contemplate life as experience, you realize it's a continuous experience of being irritated. That the sense realm that we live in is that way. Since sensitivity means that it's forever changing from pleasure to pain, it means that what we have to look at or hear or smell, taste, touch, our retentive memory brings up a pleasant or unpleasant thoughts or memories from the past, and in the future is the unknown, and that is frightening, to not know, not to be really sure what will happen to me in the future. If I am this body, I am this person, this personality, this being, then you know, what's going to happen to me? Will I be able to live a life, you know, of just, you know, continuous praise and love and acceptance and good health and good friends and success and so forth? Or maybe it'll all go wrong. Maybe everything, I'll lose my health. Everybody will, all my friends will leave me, and I'll suffer from humiliation, pain, misery, and sickness, and then the inevitable death. So this sensitive state that we're in, it means that we are in a state of danger. For example, there's a lot to fear as a human individual, in that having a human body means that it can easily be damaged. We realize how fragile just the human body is, how sensitive it is. This sense realm that we live in is like this. It means we're so bombarded continuously by sensory impingement of all kinds that we don't have that much ability to control it. So we develop various mechanisms of kind of filtering or ignoring or forgetting, or you're trying to live in a realm of delusion, of tell me everything's all right, tell me I'm okay, that life is just going to be, a wonderful experience for me, and that everything will work out for me, and that I'll be able to keep my health through old age and so forth. Or maybe they'll discover ways of preserving us so that we don't have to die. That's one hope. But then in awakening to the present, we're observing the way it is, not the way we might like it to be, but that the sense, being sensitive, is like this. So we're using an attentiveness to this present moment, observing, just noticing what it is like to experience sensitivity. So much of the sensitivity then can be quite painful, isn't it? Like sitting too long, or this the feelings of that come into the body. The things that might come into our senses, and what we might hear or see or smell, the taste or touch, are like this. So with reflective awareness, using awareness in order to reflect on the way it is, we're just noticing that pain or irritation or anxiety, whether it's mental or physical, is the way it is. It's like this. So it's not a complaint or a judgment about it, but it is an honest recognition of the experience of this present moment as is, in a way of allowing it, life to be the way it is, rather than forever struggling to kind of make something that you don't, if you're experiencing something unpleasant now, to try to get rid of it, try to resist, force it away, or constantly be trying to get pleasant states, or, you know, trying to just constantly be seeking for happiness and pleasure all the time. Much of our life is neither pleasant nor painful, and that we're rarely conscious of. We don't allow our consciousness to, we don't use our consciousness to observe neutrality or neither pleasure nor pain. Usually this is ignored, and our say, the ignorant human being is usually in the constant kind of search for happiness and running away from unhappiness, seeking pleasure and trying to get rid of pain. So when we talk about samsara, then that is this endless kind of cycle of just running around trying to get something, the pleasure, just hold on to happiness. And the very effort to try to hold on to it is painful, isn't it? The more you try to hold on to what you love and like and makes you happy, they're actually suffering a lot from the very effort to try to keep something that whose very nature is impermanent and changing. So this itself brings us so much suffering. So this first noble truth, then the insight, in its three aspects, is to understand suffering should be understood. So then we tend to think understanding suffering is to analyze why do I suffer, and then we can, because I am, I am this way, and I should be more that way, and I shouldn't be feel this way, and my suffering is caused because of abuse when I was young, or because of various misfortunes that have come my way, or been thrown at me by life. But that's not what we're looking at. We're not trying to understand suffering through analyzing it, but through standing under it. Or really, no, suffering is like this. Dukkha is like this. So the Buddha used the dukkha, or the suffering, as a noble truth, because he's encouraging us to awaken to suffering rather than just try to get rid of it. And that changes our relationship to this sensitive realm. Rather than seeing it as a constant danger and threat that we have to protect ourselves and try to control everything for our own benefit, we begin to have this sense of opening to it, opening to our sensitivity, opening, embracing suffering, really taking an interest in it, fully allowing suffering to be allowed as a fully conscious experience, to understand it, to know it, to really even welcome it in this way of a noble truth. That is where this is where we experience awakening. So that is what we mean by refuge in Buddha, Bhutang Sarangatthami, isn't it? We're really awakening. We're learning to trust in awakening rather than in some abstract idea of Buddha. Because then this is something that we can actually is a refuge for us wherever we happen to be, in whatever condition we happen to be in. It's not just a perfunctory statement that you make when you come to a Paigiri and say Bhutang Sarangacchami, or is it just a custom of Theravada Buddhism in an exotic ancient language of India, but it is a reality. It's something, a refuge that you can really trust in, and that is a refuge no matter what's happening, how your physical, mental, emotional, psychic conditions, whatever way they happen to be, one can always awaken to them. There's always this refuge of being fully awake to the way it is, to the Dhamma. So doing this First Noble Truth, just taking that as a kind of clue to enlightenment. It's taking something banal, isn't it, and something ordinary. It isn't like suffering of any great, you know, it's not like being crucified on a cross or being you know, tortured and abused and by demons. It is just the suffering that nice white middle class people feel when they can't get what they want, or they have to wait in a queue, or the traffic jam, or the worry about paying the electricity bill, or any whatever, about even the most kind of trivial anxiety or worry that we might have, is then put in the context of a noble truth. Because our relationship to it changes from identity, identifying with it, from rejecting it, dismissing it, or blaming it on somebody, or blaming ourselves for it, but really understanding it, recognizing that dukkha or suffering is like this. So the awakening is where actually the Buddha emphasized this awareness and the sati panya, which is like mindfulness and wisdom, or sati sampajanya, mindfulness, and a kind of apperception, an intuitive understanding of this moment as is. Sampajanya means to embrace the totality of being present. So it includes everything at this very moment. Now, our minds are conditioned to use our analytical faculties. And so, like in the Western world, we've raised up academic attainments and achievements as kind of the ultimate, the plus ultra of human endeavor is to have a PhD, or to have achieved this great analytical ability. So this is how we tend to think, and how we're educated to always see in terms of good, better, best, and so forth, how things should be. We're very good at living in a world of ideals, of how I should be, or you should be, or how a Buddhist should be. In the Buddhist world, they get tremendous idealists who have, you know, strong views about what a Buddhist should be, or a Buddhist monk, or a Buddhist nun, or how this country should be, or how the world should be, or how anything should be. We're quite capable, all of us, of creating these superlatives and attaching to them and identifying with them. In monastic life also, isn't it? Having been a monk for so long, I've seen so many monks very idealistic, attached to all these ideals of this monk who's selfless, who's content with little, who's grateful, who's full of metta, loving kindness and compassion, who's filled with mudita, sympathetic joy, and who has equanimity, who has samadhi, who is content with little. And so we, you know, these are kind of very lovely ideals that we have. But they are ideals. I mean, they're the kind of they are only that. They're not living realities. Ideals are creations of our minds, and of course these are superlatives. They're things that they're best. What you can conceive of is totally fair and just and right and good. But then life right now, as we awaken to this present moment, it's not ideal, is it? It's not an ideal. It's like this. It's a sensitive experience. Sensitivity is not like ideals have no sensitivity. You know, they're perfect, but they don't feel anything. So when people are very idealistic, they oftentimes lose their sensitivity. Because you meet them a lot, they're very judgmental and very hard on themselves and others, because you shouldn't be like that. You shouldn't feel this way. Life shouldn't be in this way. There shouldn't be. I remember as a child thinking, why did God create mosquitoes? If I were God, I wouldn't have created mosquitoes. He shouldn't have created. Why did God create physical pain? I remember, you know, as a child, like falling down, skinning the knees, and the blood coming out. And why did God create pain? If I were God, I wouldn't have created pain. Ask my mother that; she could never quite answer that question. You should never question. God knows what he's doing. But in terms of logic, you know, if God is, you know, if you're creating God as an ideal, then everything should be an ideal. You know, they shouldn't have anything other than the best. But then in terms of the reality of our conscious existence, life is like this. It's not an ideal. It's the way it is. So this is where the Buddha asks us to awaken to the way it is, rather than try to make everything into an ideal or how we would like it to be or how we think it should be. Because this sense realm is forever changing. It's birth and death. It's good and bad, right and wrong. It's day and night, male and female, and all the rest of the dualities, and all the variations and permutations that take place in terms of conditioned phenomena that is beyond our control. We have to just put up with it. So much of life is just learning to endure and to bear with things that we don't want or don't like, don't approve of. So just note, like the Buddha asks us to examine sensitivity, the sense realm, the ayatanas, the vedana, the sanya, sankara, and really examine and investigate it, to look at it not in terms of good and bad, right and wrong, but as experience. You know, what is it like? What is this suffering? What is happiness? And so we begin to notice that happiness is impermanent, suffering is impermanent, and the sensory experiences that we have, you know, pleasure is impermanent and pain is impermanent. So that these three characteristics of existence, anicca, dukkha, anatta, are an invitation to explore sensitivity and the conditioned realm of the five khandhas and the six ayatanas. And to explore and examine means we have to accept it. I mean, it's not trying to get rid of it or condemn it, or sometimes we do get the impression that samsara, we've got to, you know, I want out of samsara, I want nibbana. The world is anicca, dukkha, anatta. It's all dukkha. And we can become very judgmental, see the conditioned realm always as something threatening and dangerous, and we can easily become quite annihilationist in our attitude towards sensitivity or the sense realm, wanting to live maybe in a realm of equanimity, of peace and harmony, forever and ever, and because we don't know how to bear with or endure or relate or learn from the changing conditions that we experience. So awakening to dukkha then allows us to change the attitude from trying to get rid of it to willingly, to gratefully even learn from it. Because it's a noble truth rather than something horrible that's happening to me. So saying dukkha, even on a highly personal level where one's emotions are full of despair or resentment or anger or fear, anxiety, and all these, the attitude then of awakened awareness is a willingness to really know and feel and examine these kind of states of that we're having, that we're experiencing. So I use this term welcoming I found helpful to me, because I found in my own character is one to resist it. You know, it isn't even intentional, it's habitual. I'm a habitual resister of dukkha. And so I can intellectually think, I'm welcoming dukkha, I should welcome dukkha, but then the habit tendency, almost automatic, is to resist it. So developing upayas or skillful means in order to not be caught in this habitual pattern is, I've used the word welcoming, and taking an interest in the dukkha rather than just seeing it as how can I get rid of it, or just fooling myself thinking if I accept it maybe it'll go away, kind of playing games with myself, but really this attitude of totally accepting, willing to feel pain or feel grief or feel despair and really embrace that feeling, really notice it, but not analyze it, not think about it, but to fully accept it for the way it is in this present moment. Now, of course, the problem that many of us have had is always that we want to analyze it and we think, because we're obsessed with thinking. So it's very difficult to embrace emotion without running away with our own thoughts around it, because strong emotions trigger off habitual obsessive thinking patterns and memories. So learning to stop the thinking mind was the great challenge to me in my early monastic life. So this developing upayas or skillful means toward a realization of non-thinking or emptiness, or what really, really fascinated me from the very beginning was the relationship of the conditioned to the unconditioned. The relationship of samsara to nibbana, or the relationship of self to non-self, from atta to anatta, or the relationship of grasping to non-grasping. So this exploration, say, is to pay attention to, say, that which is, say, in terms of thinking and non-thinking. Just trying to stop thinking because you don't want to think anymore doesn't work. you know, just a willful act to make yourself stop thinking, it doesn't work. Because it is based on ignorance, on the idea of not wanting to think. So just by trying to think about not thinking, you end up going, you know, it's a catch-22 problem. So you end up thinking more about not thinking. And you feel, you know, really that it's an impossible thing that you're expecting to do. So instead of thinking about it or willfully trying to stop thinking, you begin to notice when there is no thought. So notice when you're really concentrated on the breath. You know, as you stay with say the physical body, just awareness of the body as an object, the thinking process stops, or the inhalation exhalation. There's notice that when you inhale, there's awareness of something that's happening right now, but the thinking process isn't, you're not thinking, it's just you're with this actual physiological happening. Or the posture, just being aware of the four postures, sitting, standing, walking, lying down, or of sensation. It's like this sweeping through the sensations in the body, you're actually with what is happening right now without thinking about it. You're noticing, or if you're using thought, say, then you're using it to point to something rather than to analyze or criticize or compare one thing with another. You just like, with this sweeping through the sensations of the body, you might think, you know, right hand or something, but that's in order to pay attention to that particular part of your body as it arises in consciousness, as you experience it in consciousness. Or you can with mantras that you use the word Bhutto is a kind of mantra, which is the mantric form name of the Buddha. So you mean Bhutto, and that itself is, you think Bhutto, but you're deliberately thinking, and there's awareness around that thinking, isn't there? So you're aware before you think Bhutto, and where the Bhutto ceases, you're aware of the space around Bhutto, so that you're not just obsessed with the mantra itself, but exploring it in terms of experience, that you're recognizing, fully conscious of non-thinking, thinking, and then non-thinking is like this. Then the silence, I guess, I've talked a lot about sound of silence, the kind of background resonating. Is it a sound? Is it tinnitus? what is it? You know, there's an endless desire to kind of name it in some way as something or other, but it is the way it is. And so, at this moment, then we're sitting here, and you know, we're aware, as we awaken to this present moment, there's the breath, the body, the sound of silence. We can then be aware of just what kind of mental state are you experiencing right now. You know, emotional. So you begin to just notice that emotionally or whenever you're feeling this way, you're not judging it. You're just noticing that feeling confused or feeling happy or sad or whatever is, or angry or whatever is like this. So there's no judgment in satisampachanya. It's not saying how you should or shouldn't be feeling. It's just noticing the feeling, the emotional state, and it needn't have any quality to it that you can name, but you're recognizing in a direct way. It's like this. So you're developing, you're beginning to awaken to the way it is, and trusting in this awakened, natural state of awakeness. It's a natural state. It's not a it's not like a created state. And the Buddha asked, encouraged awakening. It wasn't asking us to develop kind of superhuman powers of any sort, but to learn to trust in the natural way things are, in nature itself, in the Dhamma. Learning to relax and to trust and to open ourselves to the flow of life as we experience it through consciousness. So this awakened awareness isn't a personal thing. It's not like that it's something I can do, and my personal kind of ability is to be awake and where others can't do it very well, or that my awakeness is my own personal awakeness. It's Ajahn Sumedho awakeness. Awakeness doesn't belong to anybody, isn't it? It has no personality, because it's a universal reality. It's not a personal ability. So awakened awareness, or satisampachanya, is a transcendence of the conditioned experience, because it allows us to see conditioned phenomena as an object. So the unconditioned then is as simple as that. By the simple imminent act of awakening, paying attention to the present, we are actually realizing the unconditioned. It's a reality that embraces the condition. It's not a rejection or a judgment on any of the conditions. It includes all conditions, good and evil. So pain. Why did God create pain? If I were God, I wouldn't create pain. Pain belongs as a condition that belongs in this, if that's what one is experiencing in this moment. There's nothing wrong. It belongs. Everything belongs. There's nothing. There's no condition that shouldn't be. They're all what they are. They are the way they are, and their natures to arise and cease. And they're not personal. They're not self. So knowing this then is from an intuitive awareness, in which we can realize the anatta, or the nibbana, or the deathless, or the viraga, desirelessness, nirodha, cessation. So this realization, is awakening to reality, to the way things are, that all conditions that arise cease from external sources. I used to long for a kind of enlightening experience where thunderbolts would kind of come down, and I'd be kind of zapped with a lot of light, and the voice from above would say, "You are enlightened, Samatha." Because I couldn't trust in the imminent act. It didn't seem enough. Or, do I dare? Do I dare be enlightened? Ask yourself. Do you dare to be enlightened? Or is it more comfortable to think, well, I've got a lot of work to do in the future. I hope maybe I'll become enlightened. But little old me doesn't dare to assume enlightenment is even near, because it's frightening, isn't it? What do you do if you're enlightened? What do you do next? So it's not a matter of seeing enlightenment as some ideal, isn't it? Not creating an ideal of it, but realizing, the beginning to appreciate a natural state of awareness that is now and always present, always available to us, if we begin to trust in it and to take refuge in it, and just paying attention. And if this throws you in a state of doubt, then know that doubt is like this. You know, just be with and embracing what is, whatever emotional, physical conditions that you are recognizing in consciousness at this present moment. So I offer this as a reflection for this evening.